Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free. And things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country. And there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, as always, my lovable and cuddly assistant, Mr. Tim Dennis. Good evening, Tim.
Howdy.
How you doing tonight, sir?
It's football season. I do well.
Yeah, it's very good football season starting off. Congratulations to the Bears, and let's hope the Vikes can pull off a win tomorrow night. And I'm sorry for everybody else we offended by not rooting for your team, but that's the way life goes. Anyway, we've got on the line with us. We got a good show coming up tonight. Thanks for tuning in. I just want to give you the heads up. If you tuned in to hear Robert Englund, better known as Freddy Krueger, unfortunately, he's in the middle of filming and editing. He is unable to be on the show, but we will be rescheduling for a future program. However, we do have Richard Crowe, the famous paranormal investigator from Chicago, that will be joining us in about 10 minutes. And after that, we have Andrew Benarski. He is an actor and best known for his new character of Leatherface in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake that came out a year or so ago, and now they're going to do a prequel to that called Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning, which comes out everywhere October 6th. He'll be joining us at the top of the second hour, and then for the bottom of the second hour, we had Bill Moseley, who's another actor. You recognize him as Chop Top from Tobe Hooper's Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, and also as the evil Otis P. Driftwood in Rob Zombie's House of a Thousand Corpses and The Devil's Rejects. But right now, we've got a friend of ours right on the line with us, a friend of Darkness Radio, Mr. Chris Fleming from the TV show Dead Famous. Chris, thanks and welcome to The Darkness on the Edge of Town.
Hey, Tim, how are you guys?
Doing great, bud. Thanks a lot for coming on tonight. For those of you that are not familiar with Chris yet, Chris is a psychic, intuitive, sensitive that appears on a TV show called Dead Famous on the Biography Channel. And that is on every Tuesday night, correct, Chris?
Yeah, every Tuesday night. They repeat it Wednesday morning, and they also run it again on Saturday.
Awesome. So if you missed an episode, you can definitely check him out there. But Chris is a friend of our show. He's going to be going out with us to the Colorado Stanley hotel trip. He'll be out there doing the investigation with us and along with some of the ghost hunters. He'll also be out at the Queen Mary trip that we're doing in January. So if you want more information on the upcoming trips, go to our website at darknessradio.com/trips, and you can find out all about the different trips we have coming up there and all the stuff Chris is going to be doing. Something I'm helping Chris out with, though, and I'm pretty excited about this one and to bring him on the show, Chris is offering a brand new service to the fans of the show and to listeners of Darkness Radio and fans of the paranormal. Chris, why don't you go ahead and talk to us a little bit about what you're going to be doing now and offering up through your site?
Well, you know, Dave, with doing the show Dead Famous, you know, I've been to a lot of different locations, met a lot of people, and since then, you know, whenever I'm talking to people, oh, you know, can you read me? And I don't like to do what's called readings because I'm not into the crystal ball thing and telling people's futures. But being a sensitive and being an empath, I'm able to pick up on people's emotions, whether they're good or bad, but predominantly kind of the negative stuff that's going on in their life. And, for example, you know, I'll be sitting across from a girl, all of a sudden I'm sitting there, I'm getting these images in my head and these emotions, and I turn to her and I go, why are you so upset about your boyfriend? And I just met this girl. And I'm like, you get so angry and you start throwing things at him. And she's like, how did you know that? It's that type of intuition, that type of empathy that I'm getting from people that has made me realize, you know what, maybe I can help people. And that's what's really important. And everywhere I would go, I would run into people like that and run into these situations where I started picking up on stuff. You know, and sometimes I got to admit, it gets very, very personal. And I try not to intrude on people's lives. So I say, you know, can I tell you something? I said, I know it's personal, but I need to tell you something. And we would have this discussion, and it would always end up with some form of enlightenment to where they would understand there's a better way to handle the situation than what they're doing. So what I realized, I've had so many people ask me, do you do readings? And the thing is I don't do readings. But what I do is something even better, and it's spiritual consultations. You know, and what that means is, you know, life is full of questions. We all have questions, and we want answers. We need answers. The surprise is that the answer actually is within ourselves. We just don't know how to access it. And by talking with people, and sometimes a person doesn't even need to say one word, I start picking up things, and then I also allow them to ask questions. And then immediately I start feeling whatever energy is there, because I do believe that we are all connected. And because we're all connected, I can somehow download what's going on in their life, decipher it, and then give them advice. Not just regular advice, but spiritual advice. And that's how it works.
Awesome. Now, if people are interested in getting a spiritual consultation with you, where can they get the information about this?
Well, the easiest way to do this, and to get a little of understanding more than what I do, than what I'm telling you right now, is go to my website, unknownmagazine.com. That's unknownmagazine.com. And on the left-hand side, you have the menu, and then you have the shop section. Underneath shop, it says spiritual consultations. Just click on that. That'll take you to a page that describes what I do, and it'll talk about the different things you can order. You can get a 45-minute session, a one-and-a-half-hour session. There's even people that, if you're afraid to talk on the phone, it's too personal, you can email me, and I'll even do email consultations. And the one thing I do for the people that really want to go all the way is I can do a special EVP consultation where we will record the conversation, and then upon playback, I will look for any EVPs. And I've got a really good acute sense of hearing.
That's awesome.
If I find any EVPs, I will fragment them, you know, place them on a disc for you, as well as the entire conversation and the raw audio from where I got it from, and decipher for you what I believe that EVP is saying, and you can hear it for yourself. Sometimes the spirits will assist in any questions that are being asked. If I don't get it, or if we can't come to any conclusion, and they will sometimes give us clues and advice, and I'll be able to write that down for you. But the best part about it is you can go there to this website, you can decide what you want to order, and it will also inform Dave, of course, it will inform you,
right.
And then Dave will contact me to set up an appointment. Now, for right now, I'm only setting up appointments on Wednesdays, and it'll be any time. I've already done a couple sessions for people in Europe, and, you know, so obviously there's 6 hours ahead, so anytime from the morning till evening, I will plan to put the time aside for anyone that needs one.
Well, that's fantastic. And again, for those of you that are just tuning in, we're talking to Chris Fleming, one of the stars of TV's Dead Famous on the Biography Channel. And Chris is a sensitive intuitive. He has, you know, been on the show now, what is this, the third season, fourth season that you just finished up?
Yeah, we finished up the third season, waiting to hear what we're going to be doing the fourth season. But from what I hear, we may be doing an evolution of the show. It might be going in a slightly different direction, so I'm waiting to hear on that.
Awesome. And Chris has been approached from people all over the world when they've had a chance to meet him to get some kind of psychic reading or spiritual help. So Chris is actually now offering spiritual consultations, and you can go to his website at Unknown Magazine, click on the Shops tab, and then read along in there. You'll find information on how you can get the readings. I'll also put up a link for it at our website at darknessradio.com. Or if you're interested in getting a reading from Chris, all you need to do is email me, dave@darknessradio.com. Just say Chris Fleming Reading, and then I'll do what I can to help you set it up. Again, his readings are always on Wednesdays. So if you do have an interest in doing that, that'd be great. Great way to contact us again is at dave@darknessradio.com. In the subject line, just put Chris Fleming Reading, and we will go from there. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us this evening on The Darkness on the Edge of Town. We'll have you back in the future here when you got some updates on what's going on. We'll also be talking to you about all the different trips we're going to be going on as well.
I'm looking forward to it, Dave. We got Las Vegas coming up.
That's right. Oh, let me also mention real quickly, we do have the Las Vegas Paranormal Conference that's going to be coming up October 1st and 2nd. You can go to TLVPC, that's like the Las Vegas Paranormal Conference, TLVPC.com, to get all the information. Chris Fleming will be one of the main speakers there, so it's a great opportunity to see Chris, meet him live. He'll be doing a seance. We'll also be doing a ghost investigation for the weekend, so it's a great opportunity to come out. And Chris, you also have a podcast now. You've got your own radio show out there, and people can link to that.
Forgot about it.
Yep.
Yeah, I've got a podcast that we launched last week called Spirit Talk, and I'm really excited about it, and I'm looking forward to cranking out the next one too. But people have not heard it yet. You can go to my website also, and it's right there on the main page. Click on it, and hopefully you enjoy it.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Chris. And we will talk to you again soon. You're listening to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. My name is Dave Schrader. I'm your host. Along with me, as always, lovable and cuddly Timmy D. We're going to be back with our next guest, Richard Crow, the paranormal investigator from Chicago, right after this.
We thought El Chupacabra meant the cup of coffee in Spanish.
Mi amo Eduardo Especial. ¿Cómo está el yay?
What you talking about, Willis?
Shows you what we know. Stay tuned. There's more to come from the darkness on the edge of town.
Mommy!
Stay in there.
Leave me alone!
Do you have ghosts?
Do you have dreams?
Do you have an interest in the unknown? Want to know more about the paranormal? Come and join us in Para Investigators, the 24/7 online paranormal chat. Visit us today at InfinityParanormal.com and tell us what's been keeping you up in the dark.
If you read Taps Paramag every month, you'll be able to tell the difference between absurd.
I could not go to work because Bigfoot stole my car.
And the creepy.
Taps Paramag takes you to view wherever you go on purpose.
From exclusive interviews with the cast of The Ghost Hunters to the latest trend technology, the feeling of the paranormal, to join our journey, we're at TapsParamag.com.
If it weren't for ghosts and aliens, these guys wouldn't be getting any action at all.
Yeah, baby!
I threw up in my mouth a little bit.
Welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town with Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis.
Good evening and welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. I'm Dave Schrader. Our guest this evening joining us here on the line is Mr. Richard Crow. He's a very famous paranormal investigator from the Chicagoland area, and he's joining us tonight for the first hour of our show. Mr. Crow is the Midwest's original full-time professional ghost hunter. He's devoted himself to uncovering Chicago's rich history of hauntings, ghosts, and other supernatural phenomena, and he pioneered the use of luxury buses and sightseeing boats to include the public on his adventures into the supernatural, so you can come along and have as much fun as he has while he's out there investigating. It's a great opportunity. And for more information, you can actually check out Mr. Crow's tours by going to his website at ghosttours.com. And that's plural, ghosttours.com. And aside from a successful haunted tour business, Mr. Crow is a sought-after speaker. He can also be seen on most televised documentaries, anything about haunted Chicago. You'll probably see Mr. Crow pop up. He's also the author of the best-selling book, Chicago's Street Guide to the Supernatural. And tonight we're going to talk to Mr. Crow about the amazing and rich history about Chicago. And, you know, before we get deep into the interview, I just want to mention that I had the opportunity, about 20 years ago, to go on one of Mr. Crow's tours. And actually, that was one of the main things that kind of kicked me into the field of enjoying the paranormal as much, because Richard had great stories to tell. We saw some fantastic places, and I actually got my first piece of actual evidence by going on a ghost tour with Richard Crow. So I guess I can credit Mr. Crow with us being here, Tim.
Yay, so,
well, welcome to the show, Mr. Crow. Thank you very much for joining us here in the darkness on the edge of town.
Thank you, and I didn't realize that I inspired you in that way. You know, I even have young kids take this tour, junior high, for instance, and they'll do history fair projects. It's just such an amazing area to delve into, and it has so many ramifications with people. It can be everything from, strict research to literature to music. I mean, there have been a number of songs written about Resurrection Mary or a classic hitchhiking ghost based on the Chicago material here. I mean, just so many different areas that the supernatural themes have been able to bleed over into, no pun intended.
Exactly. Yeah, when we went out, I had actually gone with a good friend of mine, Rick Schwartz, and it was about 20 years ago. We went on the investigation tour with you. Had never heard about a ghost tour like this before. And truthfully, I didn't hear about them again for about 10 years, and then all of a sudden it seems like they're popping up all over the place.
They're everywhere now, right. But when I began my I did a one-time tour. I fought for my geography professor at DePaul University back in 1973. And because it had never been done before, no one had ever done a motorized tour of haunted places specializing in the supernatural, I thought it was a one-time shot just to have fun with my buddies, you know, to get out there and take some people around. We had a 200-person waiting list. And so I got the mailing list from the university and filled up a couple more buses and just snowballed from there on out.
Yeah, it's an amazing tour. We saw all the great haunted spots, and you told all the stories. And actually, where we picked up our piece of evidence was we went to Hull House on Circle Campus in downtown Chicago. And we were, back then, they didn't have, like, the slats over the windows. We, Rick and I had put the camera up against the glass to take a picture inside. When we got the film back, we were looking through the pictures. He goes, oh, this one's ruined. There's something on the middle of the picture. And when he threw it at me, it ended on an angle. And when you looked at it, you realized it was a hand reaching at the window. So we automatically started backpedaling, trying to figure out, oh, well, it must be the reflection of his hand. And we remembered him putting it flush up against the window. Plus, there was no part of the hand that's blocked by the camera. So it kind of debunked itself in the fact that we caught something crazy on film, and it was an actual, you could see the hand, you could see the fingernails reaching right towards the window. And that was probably one of the creepiest pictures I've ever seen, until, of course, I went on your one of your lectures at one of the libraries out in the Chicagoland area and saw the hundreds of pictures you had to share as well. I mean, it's crazy the different photographs people came up and shared with you after the event as well. You allowed me to stand there and kind of look over and peruse the pictures with you, and some of the pictures are just amazing. You must have the greatest collection of paranormal photographs from all the people that come to these lectures and tours.
That's what's nice about being you know, exposed in this business, in this regard. People come to you and they share their stories and their material. You know, but Hull House, I'd like to point out, is just so many different things going on there at Hull House over the years. A year doesn't go by without some new discoveries being made. One of my favorite things about Hull House is something that you have to almost be an observer to catch. It's something you can miss. And that is that Hull House, during the day, if you drive by, and I'm up and down Halsted Street quite a bit, the area where Hull House is located at the University of Illinois campus. The campus is literally built around this pre-existing haunted house, if you will. And during the day, for instance, there'll often be the street lights on just in front of Hull House, just that stretch of Halsted Street, about a half a block or so up and down at either side of Hull House. And the lights are on, and they're not malfunctioning anywhere else along Halsted. And then periodically you'll have lights not function and be off at night, whereas all the other lights are functioning fine up and down Halsted nearby. So the electrical disturbances are interesting. And it even extends as far as very often you'll see a broken-down car right around Hull House, and it's like it knocks out cars and electrical systems and vehicles as well.
That's crazy.
So that's how wide-ranging the different possibilities are at Hull House.
Can you give the listeners a little history about Hull House so they know exactly what it is we're talking about?
Oh, sure, yeah. I'm sorry. Often take for granted that people are up to code here on some of the
exactly.
sites. However, Hull House is one of our most historic buildings, first of all, because it dates back historically, in importance, it dates back to 1889, 1 year after Jack the Ripper was doing his work, his handicraft, in the East End of London. And at that time, the social workers were going, well, we've got social teams now going to work in the East End of London. What is the second most evil slum area in the world to go to now and try to do some good? And Chicago's West Side got the next wave of social work. And Hull House, named after the Hull family who built the original building in the 1850s, by that time was a ramshackle building that was then commandeered by Jane Addams, the social worker, and she came here and set up shop to work with the urban poor and Irish, Italians, Poles, Jews, Greeks, Russians, Gypsies, and similar ethnic groups, thrown together in some very unsavory, unsanitary living conditions there on the west side of Chicago. So she moves in, and it wasn't very long before her neighbors were coming to her, telling her that the place was haunted, she should beware. But because she went to college and had a degree and felt that these were a bunch of ignorant peasants and peons, she didn't heed their warnings. And sure enough, her staff would later come back to her and say, hey, you know, we saw this shrouded monk-like figure walking around last night, which probably harkens back to the days when this was a hospice for the dying, or that strange fires would break out by themselves caused by a fiery poltergeist. But what's really interesting is the fact that in 1913, Ben Hecht, who's one of my favorite Chicago journalist writers, and who later went to Hollywood to write scripts like Viva Villa with Pancho Villa, I should say, with Wallace Beery and so forth, and a great writer, great character, and he would write about a young Italian girl, was believed, some said Jewish, but more likely Italian, who gave birth to a devil baby. and gave birth to a baby born with horns, hooves, and a tail. And then it was called the Devil Baby of Taylor Street. The baby was then brought from Taylor Street to nearby Polk and Halstead, Polk Street and Halstead, for Jane Addams to hide out, and eventually gotten out of the neighborhood. And this was written about at the time in 1913. And Jane Addams would deny this in her book, Stuck in 20 Years in Hull House. And then decades later, Ira Levin, in his best-selling work, Rosemary's Baby, had just taken the Chicago material and fictionalized it into a great novel. And, of course, that led not long afterwards to the classic movie by Roman Polanski. And Rosemary's Baby is a cultural phenomenon, was born, but inspired by Chicago material, Chicago folklore, legend, and probably reality.
Now, is it true, too, just as a sidebar with that, isn't Anton LaVey the one that impregnates Rosemary in that?
Chicago, Chicago has all these interesting tentacles here that reach out. Now, Anton LaVey was actually born in Chicago in 1930 at the site of where the John Hancock building now stands. The Hancock was built from 1965 to 69 and became the tallest building in the world back then, 100 stories high. And curiously enough, Anton LaVey was born right there, where the Hancock was later built, and there's all kinds of stories involving the Hancock. LaVey eventually winds up in California, of course, founding the Church of Satan back in 1966. And here's where it gets pretty curious. According to his biographers like Blanche Barton, he was the advisor to the movie Rosemary's Baby, hired by Roman Polanski because of his expertise in the supernatural and the occult, and that he played the part of the demon who had his way with Rosemary, uncredited in the movie, but he was the guy in the feather, rubber, and leather suit that begats upon Rosemary, the spawn of Satan, Rosemary's Baby, of course, Rosemary played by Mia Farrow. That's almost like a tenet of the Church of Satan, and yet there's all kinds of debate as to whether or not he really was in it. It depends on which author you go by, depends on which source you go by, and all I say is that regardless of the bottom line here, whether he was in it or not, he or his backers, of course, Anton LaVey is now passed on, but his biographers, especially Blanche Barton, do say that he was involved in this. So it is the timing is interesting because the Church of Satan was founded in 66 and Rosemary's Baby, the movie, I believe, came out in 67 or 68, but it was being filmed just after that, and that's after the initial wave of publicity that LaVey had received for his notoriety. And then, of course, LaVey being a Chicago-born individual, and then you've got another full-circle Chicago connection here, this time with Rosemary's Baby, the movie and the book.
Now, I have a quick question for you. As we were talking, Lisa from our chat boards popped in, and she wanted to know what probably a lot of people are asking at this point. Now, you've had a long, rich history of investigating the paranormal. What got you involved and interested in investigating it and learning more about it?
What spurred me on?
Yep.
Believe it or not, not having anything happen to me. I was always reading every book I could get my hands on in my younger days, and I read every book in the local library, Sherman Park branch of the Chicago Public Library. Then I got my bus pass, and I went down to the main library downtown and began to read every book I could find down there. Just out of curiosity, began to, of course, I heard stories at home from my grandparents and others, and neighborhood stories. I began to track down everything I possibly could. And, by the way, did not get any support from teachers, which is one way for sure to get me going.
Right.
You tell me not to do something. You tell me not to do something, I'll go after it even stronger than before. So I'm thinking, wait a minute, you know, these teachers are telling me there's no such thing. And I know my grandparents. I know my other sources here. They're all, if they were in court describing what they saw in an automobile accident, their word would be taken as credible. So how come they claim a ghostly encounter and that's not believed in? Just because some third party says that it's impossible for it to happen,
right,
who hasn't even looked into it. And so it was that kind of activity that spurred me on to go start going around and checking out these places. And my approach, which I've really turned into, you know, I suppose my handbook here, how to approach this, is to be the right person, the right place, the right time. I really believe that geographically there are certain places that are haunted, that something goes on. At least there have been successive reports at certain places over the years and decades. So I felt if you could be at that place at the right time when something happens, you would be a witness to that. And that's what got me into collecting the data about these different sites around Chicago.
So what was your first...
And eventually, then I did have some personal experiences.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, that begets... What was your first actual paranormal experience once you started investigating it?
Everybody's talking about seeing ghosts, and, you know, it's great to have a visual encounter, an apparition, if you will. And they do happen, but they're quite rare, and it's much more common to have an encounter with the ghosts, if you will, or if you want to use ghost in the umbrella term, you know, for meaning all the different senses and picking up on something caused by someone dead. My first experience was olfactory, was a psychic scent. And it involved, I had a couple of experiences involving a girl called Mary Alice Quinn, known as the Chicago Miracle Child.
All right.
I remember I was going out to Holy Sepulchre Cemetery, which, by the way, is where our late mayor, Richard J. Daley, is also buried. It's just southwest of Chicago. I don't live very far from there right now as we're speaking here. It's just a short distance, maybe not even 7-8 minutes away from where I live right now, right down 111th Street in the village of Worth, Illinois, just southwest of Chicago. And I knew that Mary Alice Quinn was buried at the cemetery. I knew she was in Section 7. I don't know if any of your listeners have ever gone to a cemetery looking for an individual grave. It's very hard to find unless you've got really good coordinates.
Could I get you to go back for just 2 seconds? Give people a little bit of a history on who this girl is and why you were looking for her.
I'll work it in here as we continue. So anyway, it's a case of trying to find a specific grave in a section is pretty hard, okay? But, you know, I wasn't deterred. I just went out there just on a lark here. I'm going to find the grave of Mary Alice Quinn. Now, Mary Alice Quinn died in 1935, and she had not reached her 15th birthday. She was born in 1920. She was still 14 years of age and died at an early age with health problems, enlarged heart, and so forth. Today you'd call these people blue babies, and there would be surgical techniques that you could save these people today. But back in the 1920s, 30s, whatever, you were doomed. You were doomed to early death. And during her short life, much of her time had to be spent in bed and at rest because of her physical condition. She developed a close attraction to the Catholic saint, Saint Teresa, known as the Little Flower. She tried to pattern herself after that. Now, obviously, when you're sick and in bed most of the time, you've got a lot of spare time in your hands, and she would spend much time in prayer and trying to emulate this famous saint, Saint Teresa, who was the patron saint of the sick, and who promised that if you prayed to her, that she would give a sign. She said, "I will let fall a shower of roses," which could be either some kind of mysterious apporting of physical roses, or it could just be a psychic scent of roses. So anyway, I'm going to the cemetery. I'm going to try to find the grave of this person. And I'm driving, I get into Section 7, and all of a sudden, the car is filled with the scent of roses. And I just naturally stopped the car, pulled over to the, not a curb, but pulled over to the level of grass there next to the path there in the cemetery. And the car was literally filled with rose scent. And I look, and there it was, maybe about 25, 30 feet from the roadway was the Mary Alice Quinn on the carved on the headstone. And it was just there as a sign, if you will, with the psychic scent. And I've had many other experiences with scent over the years, which, curiously, I've had more experience with scent than any of the other senses. I've smelled flowers. I've smelled pine trees. I've smelled the things that have a specific tie in here with the individual, with the spirit, with the ghost story involved. And that was a first experience with a psychic scent.
Now, she was also, people used to go to her grave like in droves, wasn't it? They used to go there for healings?
You know, it's one of those pilgrimage-type sites where people come and pray and leave things behind. They will leave behind, for instance, religious artifacts, whether it be medals or little statues, or they might leave behind children's toys or things. I mean, it's amazing the kinds of stuff that's left behind there. And another thing, too, about this, Dave, is that people sometimes come to the grave and in search of a relic, something to take back with them. They'll take a pinch of dirt, or sometimes even more than that, to have dirt from the grave of this holy person. And later, at their home, wherever they're keeping that soil, that psychic scent of roses can emanate.
Amazing.
Now, Mary Elsquin, obviously, it's an Irish-sounding name. She was Irish-American. And this taking the dirt from the grave of a holy person, of a special person, is a very, very old Irish custom, which I found in County Tipperary at the grave of a famous priest who was executed in the 1760s wrongly for a crime he did not commit and so forth. So it's an old traditional Gaelic-Irish thing that is continuing on in this day and age here on the south side of Chicagoland.
Now, is that the same cemetery that has the bride?
No.
Okay.
We've got well over 100 cemeteries in the metro Chicago area. So this cemetery, Holy Sepulchre with Mary Alice Quinn, is on 111th Street Southwest. But if you go due west in the west suburbs, there's, of course, you know, you have to site cemeteries in areas where you're not going to pollute the water table.
That's right.
So there's certain soil conditions you're looking for. So anyway, that's why you find cemeteries clumped together in certain geographic areas. It's due to the fact you don't want to get the dead bodies reeking down, leaking into the water system, polluting our drinking water. But anyway, we've got another area of high ground with sandy soil that does not allow for the polluting of the water table west. And so in the west suburbs around Hillside, Illinois, and nearby, we have a cemetery called Mount Carmel. Now, Mount Carmel may be familiar to many of your listeners if they are into gangsters, because Al Capone is buried here, his successor, Frank Nitti, many of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre-related people, the victims and the killers are buried out here. So it's predominantly Italian, but although not entirely Italian. And if you go to the grave of Al Capone, for instance, it's just on the south side of that cemetery, entrance through the Roosevelt Road entrance. But if you go to the opposite side of the cemetery and almost lined up exactly same position from the gate, but this time from the north entrance, you find not a person of notoriety, Al Capone, but a person of sanctity, and this is Julia Macola Petta, who has always been nicknamed the Italian Bride, because on her burial site, there is a life-size statue in limestone. I don't believe it's marble because the stone is just weathered too bad.
Right.
But it's a carving in the life-size in stone of a woman in her bridal gown holding a bouquet of roses. And a fabulous story about her. Now, Julia Macola Petta was an Italian woman on the near west side of Chicago, actually not far from Hull House is where she lived in the Italian community there along Taylor Street. And she married, got pregnant. It was her first child she was expecting. She and her husband were preparing for that. But sadly, complications set in, and she died of fever. The baby was stillborn. So mother and child are now dead. And as was the custom, this is 1921, as was the custom back in those days, and I'm sure it probably still is, although we don't lose so many people in this regard, thanks to our current state of medical knowledge. But back then when that would happen, when mother and child died together, they'd be buried together. And so the mother is buried with her child in her arms. But she was buried in her wedding dress. She was buried in the white of her wedding dress because it was an old Italian belief, old world European custom, that if you died in childbirth, it was like dying a martyr's death, and therefore you're told to be buried in the white of a martyr, the color for a martyr, buried in a white dress. So that's why she was buried in that fashion, which causes some confusion over the years because people don't understand why she's depicted in the wedding dress when she actually was married and a mother, albeit a stillborn infant when she did pass on. So cut to the chase here. She's buried out here in 1921, and then her mother, the mother of Julia Macola Petta, Philomena Macola, began to have a series of dreams and claimed that the dead girl came to her to beg and plead to have the grave exhumed. And it took 6 years, but eventually she would go to the church and finally get the ear of some sympathetic priest, and they got permission to open the grave. Now, once you're buried in a Catholic cemetery, by the way, you're theirs. You know, it's hard to get this done, so it took 6 years. And the grave is opened up. They take the casket out of the ground. And then the reason for these dreams, for this, you've got to dig me up, you've got to open my grave, is what the dreams were saying. It became perfectly clear because as they opened the casket, inside the casket, despite, you know, 6 years of cold winters and warm summers and no special embalming techniques and no concrete bunker like today, but just a wooden casket in the ground, Julia was in perfect condition. And the baby in her arms had decayed and turned to bones and dust. So to the mother, this meant that this was a sign from God, a miracle that must be given credit. So by public subscription, family, friends pulled their money together, and they erected this beautiful monument showing Julia life-size in her wedding dress. And on the base of the monument are two photographs. And here's the photographic proof of the story. One photograph shows Julia on her wedding day, and that's the statue. That's the photograph that the statue is copied from. Beneath that is a photograph of her lying there in the casket as it's just being opened up, and there is loose dirt lying about. You can see the veil on her head is askew to one side. She's jostled open. The casket is jostled open, and so she's a bit disheveled. And you can see just the perfect rosy cheeks and everything else. I mean, here she is in perfect condition. So this was known as the local miracle here of the Italian bride. But now we get into the case where after that, people claim they've seen her walking about the cemetery area, her ghostly image on occasion. And it was actually on one of my tours that we made a discovery. When I was doing a tour, I do a lot of school groups. I love doing school groups.
Sure.
Kids get into this, and they learn a lot about Chicago history and everything else. And it was Notre Dame Girls High School. I'll never forget this. And we're out there, and all of a sudden, we start smelling roses around the grave. And the only roses present were the stone roses in the bouquet the statue was holding. So here's another olfactory situation.
Sure.
So we have both the visual, the apparitions, if you will, of her being seen walking about that part of the cemetery. You've got the olfactory with the scent of roses. And one further thing is that sometimes people don't see anything or smell anything, but as they drive by along the street, and the road right there, this is like just inside the cemetery fence by about 50 feet, certainly less than 100 feet. So it's plain to be seen from the roadway there. And people see the monument as they drive by. They often pay attention to it. And sometimes they claim they hear a woman crying, an adult sobbing of a woman. So it's believed this is all related, of course, to the case of Julia Bacalapetta.
Awesome. Well, I'll tell you what, for those of you that are just tuning in, you're listening to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. Our guest this evening is paranormal investigator. He's also a lecturer. He's a tour operator. He's an author. His name is Richard Crowe. We're going to be back with Mr. Crowe with a couple more stories and then hear a little bit about some of the new programs that he has going on as well. We'll talk about that right after this.
Don't you dare move. There's more to come from the Darkness on the Edge of Town with Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis.
2006 is here, and for many of you, another year has passed without treating you and your loved ones to a much-needed getaway. Rocky Shores Resort has just what you're looking for. Join owners Jerry and Kim Pip at their family-themed resort that offers a heated outdoor swimming pool, volleyball court, playground, spacious lodge with games and activities for the whole family and more. With 6, 2, and 3-bedroom cabins that are affordable, comfortable, and fully furnished, and 12 seasonal RV sites, Rocky Shores Resorts is perfect for a private escape or for a family reunion. The resorts are located on the east shores of Bowstring Lake in the heart of the Chippewa National Forest. Here you can relax and enjoy nature in the Great North Woods, experience dozens of area attractions, and get hooked on some of the best northern perch, panfish, bass, and walleye fishing in northern Minnesota. Call 1-866-878-0101 to book reservations or check out their website at RockyShoresResort.com for more information. This year, don't ignore the call of the wild. Embrace it and enjoy yourselves. That number again is 1-866-878-0101. Rocky Shores Resort is open year-round. Call today.
Come one, come all to the Circus of Terror, known as Crypticon, the greatest horror convention in Minneapolis. Ever wanted to look Captain Spaulding dead in the eye? Well, Sid Haig will be at Crypticon this year. Just don't look him in the eye, it drives him crazy. Bill Moseley will be there as well. Let's say your tastes run a bit on the freakish side. Well, step right up as Crypticon welcomes Mutt Berriman from the original Hills Have Eyes and Ken Foray from Dawn of the Dead and Devil's Rejects. If your tastes run a little bit to the softer side, we'll step right this way and meet Priscilla Barnes and Kira Schoen Stallone from the original Night of the Living Dead. And what Crypticon wouldn't be complete without Alex Vincent from Child's Play and John A. Russo, the author of the screenplay for the original Night of the Living Dead. And of course, the scariest attraction that you could think of will be there as well. What am I talking about? Well, it's Dave and Tim from Darkness on the Edge of Town. Crypticon takes place on September 15th to the 17th at the Medina Entertainment Center in Medina, Minnesota. Find out how to get your tickets by going to CrypticonMinneapolis.com. Go to Crypticon Minneapolis right now and get your tickets before they're gone.
Do you want to take charge of your life? We all have our demons we want to get rid of. This is Russ Clark. My Hypnosis CD series will help you take charge of your life and kick those demons out. Thousands of people have made personal improvements through the power of hypnosis. Your success is guaranteed by me, or I will refund 100% of your investment. To kick those demons or to add relaxation into your life, visit my website, www.powerhypnosis.net.
Mommy!
Leave me alone!
Do you have ghosts?
Do you have dreams?
Do you have an interest in the unknown? Want to know more about the paranormal? Come and join us in Para Investigators, the 24/7 online paranormal chat. Visit us today at InfinityParanormal.com and tell us what's been keeping you up in the dark.
Welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. My name is Dave Schrader. Our guest this evening is Mr. Richard Crow. For more information on Mr. Crow and on the tours that he leads, you can check out his website at ghosttours.com. And again, that's plural. It's G-H-O-S-T-T-O-U-R-S.com. Get all the information on Mr. Crow's books, on his lectures, on just about anything that he's doing, and the great tours that you want to be a part of. You can go get all that information there. There's also links to buy his books and so on. And Tim was just reminding me, Mr. Crow, before I went to a commercial break, it's kind of funny how things come full circle. It was about 18 years ago when I was working at a little college radio station with Tim, and we were doing a Halloween special, and we said, boy, we should get somebody cool on the show. And I had just been on the tour with you, and you were gracious enough to come on the college radio station and do an interview with us. So it's about 18 years ago this week. As a matter of fact, we pre-recorded that show.
I'm glad you guys have stayed with it. And, of course, I'm going to be in it for the long haul because I'm too old to learn any new tricks at this age.
That's right.
And one of the more profound lines you told us before the interview, Mr. Crow, I remember it like it was yesterday. It was like, hey, you snot-nosed punks, I can't believe I'm giving you my precious time. You better make the most of it. And that inspired me to do what I do today. No, I'm kidding.
Well, let me go real quick. I would like if we could cover two more really kind of neat stories that I liked from Chicago, and then we'll get into what you're doing now. One of the other things that I was really intrigued by when we did our original tour with you was the haunted or the, I don't know what you want to call it, the haunted totem pole that stood up. And if you could tell a little bit about the history and the story and tell people what happens in some of the pictures people take, it's amazing.
Well, Native American magic and belief, of course, has to do with many aspects of life. And I love totem poles. I love wood carvings. I love any kind of art of that nature. And the totem pole, which was not done, of course, by any indigenous tribes here in the Midwest, nonetheless was very popular on the Pacific Coast. And it was J.L. Kraft of Kraft Food fame who back in the year 1929, while visiting Canada on vacation, brought back some totem poles of a Native American village, and one he gave to the children of Chicago. And that was erected along Lakeshore Drive, our famous Lakeshore Drive here in Chicago, at Addison, set up there right along the very well-traveled road. And so people whiz by there constantly, and some stop for picnic groups, and some picnic setting. They'll stop for get their photograph taken with the totem pole. It's such a totally picturesque sight. And then, as you mentioned, with the photographs, what happens is people taking photographs over the years, and they'll often, you know, come there a number of times. You know, they'll come back there a few years after one group of friends is there. They'll bring others there, take photographs, and in comparing photographs, put it away in a family album. As they check it out later, they realize, wait a minute, there's something going on here, that this photograph shows a figure on the totem pole standing one way, and this photograph shows drastic movement. We're talking basically about a figure of a warrior. The totem pole that I'm describing, that as all totem poles do, tells a story carved in wood. It shows a whale hunt. It's a whale balanced on his nose, and on the top of the whale's tail, highest point of the totem pole, is a thunderbird. And the whale is on his nose, and halfway up the back of the whale is this hunter, warrior, harpoon guy who's about to stick his weapon into the back of the beast. And in some photographs, his legs are bent one way, and sometimes in other photographs, they're bent yet another, and his arms are one way in certain photographs, akimbo in another. And so it seems like he's wiggling back and forth. Now, at first, suspicion fell upon the photographer, the time of day, the way the shadows fall upon the figure, but the motion is more radical than that. And then others have thought perhaps the city of Chicago Park District, who maintain it, could have even gone so far as to saw the arms and legs off and nailed them back in a position and repainted them. But we know that can't happen because the city of Chicago workers are not known to make extra work for themselves.
Right.
But the thing is that there is this seeming motion in photographs. And so that's been going on. Until the mid-80s, when the original totem pole was actually taken down and sent back to Canada, where it came from, because it was a very valuable artifact, and because it was just falling to rack and ruin out there in the Chicago air, not to mention vandalism by street punks and all that.
Right.
So a duplicate was actually put up, paid for by the Kraft Corporation, donated to the city, and erected under the auspices of Tony Hunt, a well-known Native American artist. And the copy is put up, and lo and behold, the supernatural stories continue, but in a slightly different way. Now people are not talking about movement of the legs and arms of the warrior figure, but the replica warrior figure here on the replica totem pole often is surrounded by this ectoplasm, this mist-like substance. I mean, everybody's got their digital cameras these days, but if you remember, before the digital cameras came in and before the advent of the so-called orbs, a sure sign of hauntings would be this kind of mist-like ectoplasm
right.
substance on film, and that's exactly what was going on there.
Now, wasn't it, too, that when it was sent back by the late Mayor Harold Washington, didn't he die soon after that as well for removing the totem pole, was the theory?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of bad luck connections with that totem pole. And maybe the most interesting, I'm not sure whether or not we can lay any blame on our late Mayor Harold Washington's death with that totem pole, but it is a fact that the totem pole faces due west. Now, as I'm sure your listeners even more so are aware, facing the west, going into the west, these are all euphemisms for going to the land of the dead. The west is the land
right.
of the setting sun. And the Native Americans certainly believe that, and they would never have a totem pole face west. Because traditionally, totem poles face the rising sun, the east, to bring good luck to the area, to the village, and so forth, to the people that set that up. So this is actually in reverse of what the Native Americans would do, Wittershins, if you will. And so it's facing due west. And what's due west of the totem pole that faces down Addison at that point on Lakeshore Drive? Wrigley Field. And so the perennial losers of Chicago, the Chicago Cubs, play all their home games under the watchful gaze of this cursed figure, this little warrior.
Very cool. Well, let's talk real quick. We've got about 10 minutes left on the show. Let's talk a little bit about the new program that you're doing, and then if we have time, we'll come back and talk a little
okay.
bit about Resurrection Mary. But let's talk about the new trips and tours that you're doing as well.
You know, you sound just like the person who goes in the antique shop, Dave, and says, what's new? You know,
exactly.
But nonetheless, there's always a new twist, let's put it that way, even though a lot of the material dates way back. And what I've done, so many of these different tours and concepts happen by accident, or if you believe in accident, I don't think there is coincidence. It was the end of last summer that I was contacted by a group of ladies from a book club. Now, book clubs, of course, thanks to Oprah, are very popular all around the country. And these ladies had read The Devil in the White City, the best-selling nonfiction work about the serial killer, H.H. Holmes, a.k.a. Herman Mudgett, who killed 27 or more people during the World's Fair of 1893 here in the south side of Chicago. And they were enamored of that story, and they asked me if I could put together a tour based on that. And I said, well, you know, it's funny you bring that up, because I grew up not far at all from the site of Murder Castle, 63rd Wallace, because I grew up 55th Street. And so anyway, it wasn't long, and I had this two-hour package. They only wanted a two-hour short tour. highlighting material about the World's Fair of 1893, the site of this Murr Castle, connections with Burnham, the architect of the World's Fair, and also his father-in-law was John Sherman, who ran the Union Stockyards on the south side of Chicago. And I was, as a kid, I could smell the stockyards every day. I mean, I'd go to bed with the window open, you know, in the summer, you'd even hear the cattle. I grew up just a mile from the stockyards. You could hear the cattle in the nighttime breeze, waiting to wake up in the morning, get their head bashed in and be turned into sausage or steaks or whatever.
Oh, nice.
But anyway, this is all something I was very familiar with, and there are indeed supernatural connections with Mudgett as well. This tour is not as much supernatural as my other ones, but there is enough there, certainly, to pique the interest of any of your listeners who are into the supernatural, because if they've read The Devil in the White City, if they know about the Herman Mudgett connection here, they know, for instance, that the building was torn down, or burned down, actually, and in its spot these days, there is the Inglewood Post Office, United States Postal Service, and that's been plagued by all kinds of difficulty ever since it was put up in 1938, with people claiming ghostly sounds, ghostly vibes, if you will. And what's curious, I call this a cerebral haunting, if you will, in that it's not necessarily something that you see, smell, feel, hear, you know, pick up through the normal senses. You know, it's not a cold spot, it's not auditory, it's not right. Olfactory, it's not visual. But what it is, it's just like a feeling in your head of sadness, of melancholy, of I want to get out of here, I can't hack this, I've got to get away from this area. That's the kind of sensation that permeates the spot where so many of the bodies. Now, unlike John Wayne Gacy, who, of course, just dusted bodies at quicklime and buried them in the crawl space, Mudgett was industrious enough to have vats of acid and crematoriums built in this building. So he actually did a major destruction job on bodies of the corpses of those he killed. So that's one reason why we don't know for sure how many he killed. And also, you know, that I'm sure that had a lot to do with maybe why there's very good potential for multiple hauntings here at this particular spot. And years before even the book The Devil in the White City came out, I had received a letter from a woman who grew up in the area. Now, the area these days, by the way, is not the best neighborhood. It's sort of a nasty neighborhood, to say the least, Inglewood. But this woman was there years ago, and she said she could never walk down that side of the street as a child because of these weird feelings that she had, and only later that she learned that that was where this Murr Castle of this Dr. Mudgett existed. So we had that, and then last year, Dave, I'm a stamp collector, so I prepare every Halloween. I don't know if you've ever seen any of the commemorative envelopes I do every year for different hauntings around Chicago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I decorate my correspondence with this by having these unusual envelopes, and I prepared an envelope with a photograph of the post office that exists there today with a little commentary on the envelope about the fact that this is where Murr Castle existed, and I wanted them postmarked right there at that post office. In other words, they were postmarked on for Halloween at the actual site where this activity took place. And in talking to the postal employees, myself and my my buddy Tim, who's a big postal history stamp collector, we found out from the people there that there's all kinds of stuff going on there as of this very day.
Awesome. And so you're doing a new tour, talking a little bit about
the brand new tour, which incorporates aspects of the social history of the 1890s and of the World's Fair, and also of the Murr Castle and the ghostly goings on. It's my Gaslight Murr and Magic tour. I hesitate to call it Devil in the White City tour. I'm not sure about the trademark or copyright situation there. Let's call it the unofficial Devil in the White City tour.
Right.
But it's got some material for there, but of course it's historical material, and it's got additional material that was not in the book, which I sort of thought fit in quite nicely. For instance, we have a nice lunch on that one at a family-owned restaurant from 1881. Imagine a restaurant in the same family hand since 1881.
Wow.
In a neighborhood here in Chicago, right next to the Stockyards, right down Halsted Street, short distance from 63rd and Wallace, which is just east of Halsted, where Murr Castle was. We're 37th and Halsted here. And this is Schaller's Pump near the Stockyards, and so that's why they've got great, freshest meat and everything. And we got a late lunch there as part of the package. But all the details on this and everything else we discussed, of course, my various tour offerings is on my website, ghosttours.com.
Great. Well, Richard, we're running out of time here. We've only got about 2 minutes left. I wanted to thank you very much for being on the show with us. And just real quickly, maybe you can answer. We do have a question.
Sure.
Has there been anything that you've seen in the years of investigating that's ever actually frightened you?
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily frightened, but certainly titillated me here, got my adrenaline flowing, and that had to be the night back 10 years ago on Halloween night. I know that sounds too good to be true, when the entire bus saw the ghost of Clarence Darrow, Museum of Science and Industry, about 10:15 at night. It was a night I'll never forget. We had two video cameras capture the action. Some of your listeners may have noticed, may have remembered this from being on various Learning Channel, History Channel programs. Paul Harvey did a Rest of the Story episode on his radio program about this, and we did see a character dressed in 1930s fashion walk down the sidewalk across from the Jackson Park Lagoon, right where Clarence Darrow, the so-called attorney for the damned, the Leopold and Loeb case of 1924 and the Scopes Monkey trial of 1925, where his ashes, his cremated bodies had been scattered back after his death in 1938, and where he promised, a la Houdini, similar promise that Houdini made, promised to return to the dead to that spot and give a sign. And we believe that it happened on Halloween night, 1995.
Wow, and that's actually on footage. People have been able to see that?
Right. It's grainy. It's, you know, it's made with available light.
Sure.
But there was this character, this guy there, dressed like somebody from that period of history. And once again, the neighborhood's not the best. So I doubt if anybody would dare dress up and walk around that part of Chicago all alone at night for fear of being jackrolled.
Well, did he vanish then once he got to that bridge?
Well, here's how it happened. The ending was not a vanishing in the sense where he was there 1 second and gone the next, but he was standing across the other side of the lagoon from us, and two members of our party kind of run around the edge of the water and get close to him, and we're edging them out, encouraging them out, I should say, yelling, screaming, and they got within about 50 feet of the character, froze in their tracks simultaneously, and only after that did the figure turn, walk back the way he came around the side of the building and was gone. Now, what's so curious to all of us is, and we were really, mad at the two guys for stopping because we're yelling at him, you know, continue, grab him, break his down, break, knock him down, break his arm, do something, you know. And so these two guys had come back to the group and they said it was just too scary, they couldn't get any closer, but how did they both stop simultaneously in their hot pursuit? You know, it's like they ran into an invisible wall and just couldn't get any closer.
Unreal.
A lot of unanswered questions about that, but I had that all up, and I'm 99% sure we saw the ghost of Clarence that night.
Very cool. Well, Mr. Crow, thank you very much for joining us here tonight on The Darkness on the Edge of Town. And again, for people interested in more about Mr. Crow and his tours, you can check out his website at ghosttours.com. There's a link for it on our website. You'll be able to click in there and check out anything about Mr. Crow and the upcoming tours and his books. We want to thank him very much for sharing the different stories about Haunted Chicago and about some of the cool little histories that go around with the different stories as well. And please stay tuned here on The Darkness on the Edge of Town. We come back after the top of the hour. We're going to be joined by a couple of cult legend heroes. We've got Andrew Benarski, the new Leatherface, and Bill Moseley from the movie Devil's Rejects and House of a Thousand Corpses. We'll be back with them right after this.